strange world, it's so vast and deep. All these things, wild and new.
Hello and welcome to Q&A Quest, episode 405, episode not allowed. I'm your host, Mike Epps, a.k.a. Wheels, and with me as always...
Rejected Kong, dipshit Kong, David McBurney, Fanboy Master.
And, oh, that would be a good one. You should really tell me what the theme is going to be in advance here. Okay,
Donkey Kongs.
Proper weather forecasting, not allowed. Still trying to figure out when rainy season is actually stopping or starting. Your man in Japan, Michael Baker, Gaiji Minokitari. Seriously, rainy season supposedly ended over a week ago. Ugh. Somebody should tell it.
Someone should have told the rain, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, I mean, it actually... Have you ever seen the rain? It was like, rainy season actually ended almost 2 weeks earlier. And it's been thunderstorms like 4 out of the last 7 days. Short. Yeah. Including, like I was telling Wheels, there was like a 15% chance of rain for a particular hour this morning. And that happened to be the exact 15 minutes I was on my bicycle heading to school.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Ooh. Okay, so what is new?
Let's see.
Switch 2 nonsense.
What's that?
Switch 2 nonsense is new, as always.
What nonsense in this case?
Tony Hawk's.
Oh, yeah, that's what you mean.
Donkey Kongs this week, and got a Wild Hearts demo we can talk about.
Yeah, we can pop that up.
Wild Hearts is
if Koei Tecmo made Monster Hunter, but with Fortnite elements.
Which is shockingly way better than I expected.
Yeah, no, it's actually like... Especially for someone who has difficulty fully adapting to Monster Hunter. There's some stuff in there that just generally makes it feel a little more approachable, while still clearly being something that could absolutely obliterate me at any moment.
Mm.
Maybe this is something that I just haven't thought about with Monster Hunter. Does Monster Hunter, like, give damage numbers?
It did not until, I think World was the first one.
Oh, they did start doing that, okay.
Yes, it was very recently.
Yeah, because I remember, because, like, it was nice in, when I was playing the Wild Hearts demo, that it was just a little easier for me to tell, like, am I doing anything? Is anything happening here? is the thing that I'm doing now more effective than the other thing? Like, just the existence of damage numbers answers all of those questions.
Yes, before it was a lot of, like, visual and audio cues you had to learn.
And I'm bad at interpreting those.
Yes, and so was I, so I kind of just...
Didn't
bother... figuring out if I was doing better or not, and just kind of roll with it.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, you can get some like there's some universal options that comes with everyone being able to do the Fortnite shit, because you'll get like monsters that like you put down some shit to climb so that you can attack from above, but the monster, like the first monster you'll find in the demo, absolutely will just ram headlong into it. which knocks it over, and that gives, no matter what you're using, that gives you an opening to just really unload on it.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting, you know, it's nice to have just as an option for it gives you an option of what to do that allows for an opening, and I suspect, you know, some of the other monsters will have those as well. It's an ambitious port, to say the least. To put it lightly, Wild Hearts didn't run well on anything.
No.
Like in the pure frame rate sense, the console versions, like it's not a stable frame rate on anything. Like you're gonna notice that when you play the game. It is interesting that the Switch 2 version is targeting 60, which was not the case for its nearest neighbor, the Series S. The Series S version has nicer like textures and shit, but it targeted 30. In this case, they went with lower the graphics settings some more and shoot for 60. It's basically always above 30. You're gonna feel it, but it's fine. It plays well. I enjoyed what I played. It looks like it's got some cool weapon variety, and it has like a cool world. I'm looking forward to playing it some with wheels.
Yeah, and I hate to harp on this even more, but I felt like it does Monster Hunter better than Monster Hunter Wilds because it doesn't waste my time. It teaches
you. Get to that first hunt relatively quickly, and it does do a good job of teaching you how to play game.
Yes, it teaches you game as you play, which is kind of what, I mean, I'm not going to say all of them did it very well, but the best Monster Hunter games kind of let you learn as you go and don't drag you along on a horse as characters talk about things in a game that is not primarily about story.
Yep, there's a story here. It doesn't seem like it super matters. Very old school Monster Hunter.
Yeah, but it's enough, like good Monster Hunters. It's enough to just color the world and make you interested in exploring it and playing the game. And I really enjoyed the gameplay that I got to play, especially briefly messing around with the umbrella weapon, which seems really weird. Kind of want to learn how to use it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that, like, yeah, it's like a tradition. Like, when you think of a certain era of Japan, sort of umbrella style. But it's a weird little thing. It's got sort of blades involved, and it has like a weird parry when the umbrella unfolds. When it unfurls, it has a brief parry window, which makes it kind of the hard to use weapon. I am sure that wheels will face difficulties.
Yes. But in a way, the game feels kind of like a spiritual successor to Koei Tecmo's last Monster Hunter clone. I forget how you pronounce it. Tweakedon? Tokiden, yeah.
Tokiden.
Which was not the best, but it was like almost there through two games. Never quite put it all together. So I'm wondering if some of the creative talent that worked on those also worked on this.
Yeah, and S seems to just be like we've just bundled together it, like the equivalent of say Monster Hunter Ultimate, where they've just bundled together all of the updates and additional costumes and monsters and shit they've added over DLC. So that's nice. And at 50, like they're not even charging whole new game price for it, so I'm willing to take that plunge.
Yeah, and I really like the building mechanic seems a lot better than I thought it was going to be. And it really is like a nice change up on Monster Hunter. Like
it's a different game. Yes, but it's still clearly the same kind of game.
Yes. This is honestly why I liked the God Eater games back in the day. Like, yes, they're playing off of the exact same thing, but they put their own twist on it, and it's enough to make it not just feel like, what did I see someone describe it as? What do they always call, like, a lesser version of something? Like Monster Hunter for, Monster Hunter for Home?
Like, the way I would describe it is that, like, you know, it feels like a game in the same genre instead of just a...
Yes, yes, exactly.
But, yeah, so that'll be fun. That'll be a shenanigans in about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
This week's shenanigans will just be Donk Donk Donkey Kong.
Yes. I can't wait for that.
Yeah, it looks so fun. Let's see. Yeah, that comes out Thursday, as of this recording.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I was sold on it the first time that they showed it. It looks like a lot of fun to just smash through. We've gotten more info about its development over the past week or so. It was largely put together by, it was put together by some subset of the Super Mario Odyssey team.
That's exciting.
Some of the, like, the big emphasis on environmental destruction came from two things. The first was that Odyssey's lead, Yoshiaki Koizumi, asked the team to, you know, put together ideas for what a 3D Donkey Kong game would look like. Mm-hmm. And Odyssey had certain areas where, like, there was, like, mild environmental destruction. It was using voxel-based technology. Voxels being a shortening of volumetric pixel, or a three-dimensional square pixel. They are easier for math reasons to calculate destruction on.
Interesting.
Like, deformation and destruction is easier with voxel technology.
The main reason I even know the word is because there was this one cartoon that my younger daughter likes where one villain of the week actually turned everything around him into voxels.
Cool.
So it was mainly the very obviously the animation studio's excuse to basically do the entire episode in Minecraft style. It was really ridiculous. But yeah. You could strongly tell where the animation studio's interests lie for various media. Voxels.
Yeah. Wikipedia has, like, a relatively understandable explanation of why this is. As with pixels in a 2D bitmap, voxels themselves do not typically have their position, i.e. coordinates, explicitly encoded into their values, instead of rendering... systems infer the position of a voxel based upon its position to relative to other voxels. So, you're as opposed to polygons, which are often explicitly represented by their the coordinates of their vertexes or vertices. Bending, deforming environment polygons in an environment is going to, without a lot of work, create visual issues, relatively speaking, compared to something that's voxel based, where you can essentially heap off a chunk of voxels and their positions relative to each other haven't actually changed. But yeah, so they're usually, like, their strongest point in their favor is is their capacity for being manipulated in this fashion. You'll find a lot of different situations in games since the advent of 3D that have used voxels essentially for this kind of purpose. But Bonanza is as well. That's the, like, there was some, again, some experimentation with voxel tech for things like the snowdrifts that you can push through in Mario Odyssey, and they kind of built on those, and the idea that Donkey Kong is supposed to be really strong, and put those concepts together into a game with extremely destructible environments. And a game that, if I wanted to be a pedantic little nerd, I could, like, make a solid argument was more of an RPG than Final Fantasy 16.
Wow.
Out of nowhere. But, yeah, so, yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. That's in, yeah, that's on Thursday. I have,
it's a lot, like, in the next after 2 weeks.
What's that?
I said there's a lot in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, we're gonna have some fun. And I have already stomped through Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 3 Plus 4, and I'm just leisurely taking on the pro goals that unlock when you beat all goals in both games. Oh, which are fun. They're fun goals. They're generally relatively creative, and it is interesting to experience new goals in Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 3 levels after 24 years of that not being the case. So I'm enjoying that. Those are good. You kind of have to accept that THPS4 is going to be a very different experience than the original, but it's still a lovingly made remake that is, I would describe it as sort of being like THPS3 is a straight remake. THPS4 feels like a very, like, a remix, as though you got, like, a different Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 4. And, you know, that's nice after many years of not getting a proper new Tony Hawk's Pro Skater. Also, the bonus level, some of the new levels they added to 4, because 4 has a lot more rejiggering to its structure. It has some additional levels that are quite good. They cut out a few of the bonus levels, one of which was originally just pulled straight from Matt Hoffman's Pro BMX 2 and is not very good, so I had no problem seeing that go away. One of which was a bonus level in a carnival that was a little sadder to see go, because, like, the carnival was kind of a fun environment. The new bonus level is completely surreal and deranged. Like, even looking up at the skybox is slightly nightmarish. But the water park level that they've shown in a lot of the trailers is really cool, really large and detailed, and has all sorts of little things to find. And the movie studio competition park they added is compact but complex, and I enjoy that quite a bit. So yeah, it's a very good remaster. I've had a lot of fun with it, and it runs silky smooth on Switch 2, so that's all I really wanted. What have you all been playing? What have you been playing, Gaijin?
Well, I'm still doing In Stars and Time. Mm-hmm. Care to guess what the clock says now?
Oh, yeah, this was one of the, let me guess, 800 hours.
Well, let's see, well, okay, saving right now, so let's see what it gives me here. What? So, previous save earlier this afternoon was 619 hours.
That was, I am closer than I should have been.
And current save time, less than 2 hours later from when I last saved, was 623 and a half hours.
Huh.
That's normal. Everything's normal.
I mean, it's a game about time loops. I mean, obviously, the software is running on its own closed time loop. But considering I have been, considering I only turned this thing on like a week and a half ago for starting the game, And it currently thinks I've played about 21 days worth nonstop.
Incredible. Yeah.
It's still the weirdest clock-related glitch I have ever seen on a Switch game.
Yeah, I got nothing on how they're managing to pull that one off, but I'm mostly just upset that I was honestly closer than I thought I would be at guessing 800 hours. So.
Yeah. And this game doesn't even have anything time-sensitive to mess up with it.
Yeah, it's just weird.
Yeah. I mean, it's like earlier this year when I was playing Atelier Yumiya and had a similar, okay, the clock doesn't stop when you're in sleep mode glitch. At least that also had an item duping machine that relied on number of seconds on the clock. So it's like, okay, just put the game in sleep mode, go to bed, wake up again, and like, oh, I've got like 700 of a particular high level item now. Yay.
This made the game much more convenient.
Made it much, much easier to hit the high level items. Yes.
And what have you been playing, Joe?
Hello, this is Smoke and Joe Gamer, and I joined late. Sorry about that.
That's fine. No worries.
But I too have been playing Tony Hawk 3 and 4, and I also got it on Switch 2, and we had fun on Shenanigans last night, didn't we? Neither of us cheated. No,
cheating?
We wouldn't do that.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
It's crazy talk.
I legitimately got 3 million points off
I have
one
a naturally
trick.
Perfect balance in Tony Hawk games.
So, I've been playing that, and I played a lot of Tony Hawk 3 back in the day, so I know those levels pretty well, and I just got to the cruise ship, which was pretty neat. But then 4, I'm a little shaky on. Hang on. I just started a trial in Final Fantasy 14, which I will also talk about, and I just hope I don't die.
Uh-huh.
Hang on. Yeah. So, yeah, 4, I'm a little... Oh, I'm dead. Yeah, so, anyways, trying to multitask here. Yeah, 4, I'm a little less familiar with. Didn't know where a lot of things are. I still don't know where all of the skate letters are, and the levels have been rearranged a bit. And I'm okay with it being the same format as the other three games. It's less jarring to switch between them now, I'd say.
It's definitely it definitely feels more like a direct sequel to 3 in this context.
Yes. And gee, you can still play 4 like on a PS2 or a GameCube or a Dolphin emulator, you know?
So, yeah, and I'd recommend trying that because it is a very different experience, but that is not to diminish what Iron Galaxy has achieved. They did a very good job.
Yeah. Holy shit. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm in a trial. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So, I'm going to go over here. Okay.
Don't die.
So this okay, so let me talk about Final Fantasy 14 a little bit because I'm at the end of Stormblood and this guy Xenos, I think you said there was a magic card of him that's really good.
Probably.
It's one where
all
if
the
one
people I know who play FF14 have strong Xenos opinions.
Okay. Like basically if one player loses then you win or something like that.
Oh yeah, I mean that's really good for like commander for sure.
Yeah,
which means it's super cheap because magic cards are not super expensive unless they are standard playable, and then they are fucking expensive. Look at the price of Eevee.
Yeah.
No. Someone's suffering.
I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah,
I spent $50 on Eevee.
Jesus Christ. Do you need a full playset of BBs, or do you just
No, I don't play standard except in Arena, so I only need one for Commander. Thank God.
What the fuck?
So,
yeah, if you needed 4 BBs, I would weep for your wallet.
What is an active time maneuver? What does that mean?
Do you think anyone else on this show has played enough Final Fantasy 14 to answer that?
No,
question?
But this is the first time I'm seeing it. It wanted me to mash buttons, and I just barely got it in time. All right, so
sounds like a quick time event to avoid an attack.
Yeah, and nobody died. Wow. So Xenos is the main villain of Stormblood. So, you know, the main scenario has you traveling between the three cities that are part of an alliance, and you're also dealing with the icons at different points, and you have clashes with the Empire, and the whole thing
ends. Bad memories of Alpha 16.
Yeah, but it ends with just some epic clashes against the Empire.
In a Final Fantasy game?
Yeah, it's not subtle at
outrageous.
All. The Empire's evil. Yeah.
FF2 is back, baby.
But you're the Warrior of Light, and you're kind of acting as like this diplomat between the three cities. And you fight the Empire, and everything's fine. And you have some clashes with the Primals or Icons, or whatever you want to call them. So then you go into Heavensward, and that's kind of doing its own thing and kind of has its own tone, which is fine. But you're in this other city that's got like a corrupt theocracy, and there's dragons, and there's this evil dragon getting resurrected named Nidhogg, and it's all pretty wild. And, So then you go to Stormblood, and it's like, all right, let's go fight the Empire again. So there's this country that they invaded and occupied. One of your allies is from there. So you're helping these refugees fight the Empire, take back their homeland, and that's where Xenos shows up. So first time you fight him, he kicks your ass, and he's one of those villains who's like, you're not worthy yet. I'm not going to kill you. You got to get stronger and give me a good fight. So, you know, you do that. Oh, Jesus Christ. And you finally get this level 70 dungeon where you get to fight him for real, or so you think. So you beat him, and then he just laughs at you, and he's like, oh, you're finally worthy. Now you can fight me for real. I'm like, what are you talking about? I just won, didn't I? So
you're funny.
So what he does is he releases this Shinryu Vengeance Dragon thing out of its prison and fuses with it. So then you have to do an 8-player trial where you take out this giant dragon god thing, and we just won. And I only died once, and it was my first time doing it. So
it really is haha, witness my true power kind of thing.
I got 3-player commendations. How the fuck did that happen? Wow.
Congratulations on your commendation.
Yeah, people like me in this game, I guess. Even though I deny every free company invite.
Oh my god, Fire Miner, collector boxes of magic? Jesus Christ, no.
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 No, let's not put wheels through that.
My brother bought one, and he got shit from it, too.
So, let's see if Xenos has been defeated, and then I guess I'll do a bunch of quests and then be able to start Shadowbringer soon. So I took a break from 14 and wanted to get back to
hold on, no, you got to go back a second. I think what you meant to say is RP Gamer, RPG of the Year winner, Shadowbringers.
Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah.
Who's that won her RPG of the Year award?
You.
Okay.
I'm not still annoyed about that. What are you talking about?
Well, I'm not. I wouldn't say I'm mad about it. Like, you can do whatever you want, I never consider expansions to be eligible for Game of the Year, but that's just my opinion. He's no longer a dragon, but he's got blood dripping out of his mouth. And yet there is only joy, transcendent joy that I have ever known. How invigorating, how pure this feeling.
That's why he's a flippy card. Okay, that checks out.
Okay, so before you just spoil like a bunch of FF14. It's fine. I think some of our listeners might. So who cares? So Wheels, what have you been playing?
I've been playing a game I will have a preview for at the end of the month. I have also been playing Fire Emblem Engage. I'm in Destiny Engage. Right now, or I would be hitting that on the soundboard.
Thank God you didn't.
Which I continue to enjoy a lot because it plays more like the 3DS Fire Emblems. And it made me realize one of the things that I really missed in Fire Emblem Three Houses, which was one of the cool things about the 3DS games is, yes, there's romance options, whatever. But I always found it very cool that you could, like, pair up your party members together and they get their own little storylines. And I thought that was pretty cool. And it feels like there's a little more of that engaged than there was in Three Houses, which was all about your main character. And I did not find that as compelling. So I'm hoping they bring back more of that in whatever they do next with Fire Emblem.
Fire Emblem.
Engage.
Engage.
You gotta get a better sound clip because he sounds like Fat Albert.
Engage.
Also Engage. Trying to finish up Cyberpunk before lots of stuff comes out.
Good luck with that.
We'll see how it goes. I'm not playing that. Did not do the idiot thing. I'm not playing it on hard.
Good.
Also, I have Skippy, so we're all good.
I have to go back in there just to get Skippy.
He's the best.
You're really complaining that you need to kill more than 40 people.
But it is cool to see Shadow the Hedgehog and Knuckles in another game together.
Cool. Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah, that would be true in Phantom Liberty.
Well, Ben Schwartz is in there?
No, Knuckles. No, Shadow.
Shadow is Keanu.
Oh, Idris Elba. That's right.
Yeah, Idris Elba. It's Knuckles.
That's right.
I don't even know how to respond to that. Like, that just rebooted my brain, you piece of shit.
Sorry.
At the same time, I'm trying to close out Red Dead Redemption by Thursday. I don't think that's likely to happen. Like, a man can dream.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm more than halfway through. I got an exceptionally lucky random encounter, which is that if you have high enough honor in Red Dead Redemption, you have a chance of being approached at random by a nun who's like, I have heard of your heroics, and just hands you like a weird rosary. And I had no idea what this was or did. Googled it and it said, hey, this is extremely rare and people have no idea how to make it happen. But the rosary just gives you a flat, like, every shot an enemy takes has a 25% higher chance of just missing.
Wow.
So I guess that's a sign from virtual God that I should finish.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah. So that's fun. That's a fun game. I like riding around on my horse while somber whistling music plays in the background. But yeah, nothing major to report there. I just thought that was funny that I had randomly ran into one of the rarest encounters in the game.
Nice.
But yeah, most important news is the bonanzas, the donkey bonanzas.
Yeah, I got my pre-order. I'm looking forward to it.
I've got mine too. I will be once I finish work on Thursday. I will be trekking out to Best Buy to pick up my copy.
Nice. And I had an eBay gift card and got a good deal on a Switch 2 Pro controller. Or I hope it's a good deal because it should arrive on Wednesday and should be functional. So we're gonna see.
They are by all accounts very good controllers.
I love mine. I picked a seller with like a 99% rating, and they offered like a 30-day return policy. So I was like, all right, let's go with them.
Yeah, I think you'll be fine.
And then when you're talking about voxels, of course, I thought of Resogun. It just makes great use of voxels. Everything looks really cool in that game.
Yeah. Bosses don't often get used to make up environments because you have to make all of you have to keep track of the coordinates of all of them.
Yeah, so that game had just awesome particle effects, things just exploding into little cubes every time. Yeah. So then last night I talked about this emulator I tried called 3D Sen. And I think that's what they do with old NES games. Like this guy's been working on it for a long time.
Translating pixels into voxels, then.
I think that's all it does, because it makes NES games just look like Lego dioramas. And you can rotate the camera around, and it's cool for about 10 minutes, but some games have performance issues, and it's a very bare bones emulator, only supports about 100 NES games. And I ended up refunding it, but yeah, I think that's kind of what he did. I think he just tried to use voxels, and things that are supposed to be circles now look like a blocky mess, so like Metroid just wasn't very fun.
This is what ellipsoids are for.
Yeah.
You ever seen an ellipsoid-based game? Those are weird looking.
What the hell's an ellipsoid? No. I failed Otter's geometry, I'll have you know.
In computer graphics, an ellipsoid is essentially a spherical polygon.
Okay.
Hey. So what it sounded like, but I can't imagine a game made out of them.
There are a few. They're really weird looking. It's a very good technique to use if you want something that looks extremely strange, which is sometimes what you're looking for. God, there's like a very Ecstatica on the PC back in the 90s with an ellipsoid base. Video game. Let me see if I can pull up or at least the characters were ellipsoid based, which makes them look very strange. Let me see if I can pull some up.
Is Vector Man an ellipsoid?
No, nah.
Okay.
Let's see.
Is Rayman an ellipsoid?
No.
Okay.
Am I an ellipsoid?
Yeah. No.
No. All right. Yeah, so I'm just now rolling credits on Stormblood. Okay.
Congrats.
Just so you know. If I knew I was this close, I would have just kept it going before taking a break, but that's all right. Oh, and by the end of the month, I hope to have Visions of Mana finished, so I've been streaming that Tuesday and Thursday nights if anybody wants to tune in.
JRPG July, baby.
Yeah.
If you are catching this live, that means you'll be streaming it tomorrow.
Yes. At 10 p.m. Eastern Time.
7 p.m. Pacific.
Yes.
Which would mean about 2 hours before we typically start. One of the things that is a personal fascination to me is that, like, triangular polygons becoming the standard is something that happened for very good reason. But there were a lot of... Before, like, hardware acceleration made it so that, like, you build things the way the GPU is built to build things, there were a lot of attempts to, like, look at, well, what if we did use something else, like voxels or ellipsoids or other weird things. Let me see if I can remember the name of one of these. Some of them have very strange... NURBS.
What?
NURBS.
Non-Uniform Rational Beastline.
Okay.
What does that mean? NURBS.
There are at least a few games that make use of like NURBS rendering. I'm not sure. Like, I can't remember any. Like, Ecstatica, I could remember for ellipsoids, but I could not remember. I could not tell you what games made use of NURBS in their rendering in like a really advertised fashion. But yeah, it's interesting. Like, the other thing is that you get weirdness like. A voxel is fundamentally different from a square polygon. So, like, the Saturn used quadrilateral polygons, but it did not. But specifically, it must be understood it did not use voxels. They are different things. But yeah, it's fascinating. The reason that, like, not just using polygons ended up, like, winning out, but also why they are triangular polygons is interesting. It is interesting to know, to some extent, why these decisions ended up being what they were. Polygons generally had advantages for just crafting environments in general.
I keep thinking of Simpsons season 2 when Marge got into drawing and everything, you know, just a collection of circles, squares, and triangles.
Mm-hmm.
And then she had to do Mr. Burns' portrait, and she saw him naked in the bathtub and just couldn't get it out of her head. But then he loved the painting. So
he did. I think somebody else did.
Yeah,
I think it was like.
No, eventually he appreciates it.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
I just remember. Yeah. I remember that episode basically because it taught me how to actually look at things for drawing properly.
For sure. Yeah, and I took like a 3D modeling course, and we used 3DS Max, and it like, yeah, that's well, that's you, when you're thinking about what you want to make, you gotta just break it down into those shapes. So like, you want to make a train, it's like, okay, you know, you do a bunch of rectangular cubes, and then you got to do the circular wheels, and then like at one point I wanted to do like, we had to make our own video, so I decided to do a penguin walking across the desert, and he has a run-in with a vulture who wants to turn the whole world into a desert, and I had to use like a combination of like cones and cylinders and stuff to make a something that kind of looked like a penguin. So yeah, I had fun doing it. I got an A too.
Yeah.
But then I found out that software is $1,100 if you're not a student and you actually have to pay for it.
Yikes.
Yeah, so I never didn't go into that. Nope. In today's dollars, it would probably be like $2,000.
Probably something like that.
Anyway.
But yeah. It's just interesting to think about. To understand why decisions like this were made. But yeah, if you just want to make a large scale environment, polygons are friendly. Scaling in and out and level of detail easier to work with. But yeah. We should probably hit some of Fireminer's many questions.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for the Umamusume question.
We'll get them piece by piece.
Musume. I know nothing about that.
Okay, so to start with...
Osmosis.
To start with, yes? Two episodes ago, I asked about the indie games focusing less on non-Forgotten Realms settings, to which you answered that developers nowadays can just make up their own settings. Is it just me, or does it feel like we also haven't gotten a lot of original CRPGs lately? I checked Steam, and there are a good number of turn-based strategy and deck-building games that use tabletop RPG mechanics. But actually, non-linear story-based... Yeah, no. Based CRPGs are rare and far between. They're there if you know where to look, but they're definitely not as... abundant as the seemingly unending torrent of deck builders, roguelites, and roguelite deck builders. Turn-based strategy as well. I'm seeing many problems because it mostly means that there's just vast swaths of indie games that I just sort of ignore because I don't like the game genres they're in. But yeah, like I think that's down to like a really strong CRPG of that style. Like if we're talking about like Infinity Engine or you know, like BioWare or Black Isle, like any of those has just a lot of scripting and like scripting in both the like, you know, pure writing sense and in the like scripting for different variations and like special interactions. Like there's just a lot of stuff there. It's a lot of responsibility. It's a lot of work in terms of just raw generation of different play states. And indie games, for reasons of practicality, tend to favor, like, you know, since a lot of them are made by pretty small teams, but have, you know, like, a need to generate assets of a much higher level of fidelity than those games did back then, the best quote-unquote bang for their buck is to generate play states, like a lot of different play states, through the creation of rule sets that can cause a lot of different things to happen. And roguelites and deck builders both have that in them. Like they're generating environments, or the deck builder is constantly generating situations where you need to go back and reevaluate what your deck looks like, and that's generating play states. And most of the game itself is just, you know, the deck you've strategized around against the random encounters or whatever that you're fighting. And that means a relatively small amount of like environmental asset generation. You can, with every additional enemy that you're adding potentially exponentially more play states, because you have all of these, the combinations of different enemies with that force different things out of the player. Like all of those represent a lot of content bang for your buck, as opposed to making a classic CRPG style game where you're doing a lot of little like bespoke touches and a lot of environmental art and a lot of writing. And you know,
this is from a logistical standpoint, just in order to do it right and do it well, you need like at least a AA studio setup.
I'm not sure you need a AA studio setup, but you do need like a certain passion for it. Like this has to be specifically what you want to make. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I would say that might discourage this, in especially in some of the indie space, is just a lot of people who get into like indie design is self-selecting based on influences. So like it isn't just the genres that are popular, it's the genres that engender the most fascination by budding game designers. So like Metroid never sold a patch on a lot of games that it was contemporaneous with. Uh-huh. But there's a million Metroid clones. Because the kind of person who is becoming fascinated with designing, the actual discipline of game design, is going to be fascinated by the weird interlocking way that a Metroid-style game is fit together. Did Wheels' brain shut down?
No. I'm here. Okay.
I was just watching him get slaughtered in his game after he just stood there for 5 seconds.
He was texting somebody.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. But yeah, so like that, and you end up with like, among discussion about game design, you end up with this desire for games with sort of infinite interesting decisions. Like, there's an old adage that I've seen credited to a few players that a game is a series of interesting decisions. Let me see if I can find, like, where that... Yeah, that's... I think usually I see that attributed to Sid Meier. That a game is a series of interesting choices or interesting decisions. And a lot of people with the passion to pursue indie game development, which it needs to be understood, is something that takes a ton of time, a ton of effort, and which produces a lot of... and ends up often not generating a lot of money. You have to be someone who has like just a lot of passion for the act of game creation. And that ends up sort of circling back to the idea that like the kind of person who will have the will to stick through is going to be someone that has like a fascination with very like designer's design, so to speak. Like design that is fascinating to people who find the aspect, the concept of design fascinating, like the discipline itself. And mm-hmm. So with all that, like it biases towards these genres that are both achievable with the set of resources that an indie developer typically has, and which are also like likely to capture the fascination of someone who would want to spend their spare time making a video game. And so it biases towards certain genres just as a matter of like both in some sense practicality, but in some sense just like, you know, self-selecting for the kind of person who would actually be able to finish their game. But you will see indie devs that do classic style CRPGs. They're a little off the beaten path, but they do exist.
You ever play Age of Decadence?
I have heard about it. I was going to bring up a YouTube channel I've seen talk about it and a few others of this ilk called Warlocracy, which is a very good like classic sort of computer style RPG enthusiast YouTube channel that goes a lot into these kinds of games, and also a lot of like weird modding subcultures of some of the old school computer RPGs. It's an interesting channel, but yeah, I do think that there's a limited amount of these for a lot of different practical reasons. It's easier to make in a studio environment where the separation of disciplines means that, like, you know, when you're an indie dev that's wearing five hats, where it's like I'm the programmer and the writer and like doing at least some of the art, you know, it, let's say, you know, we're gonna pretend that you're somehow going to get a game out in 3 years. Like, that's a lot of, that's very difficult to do if you're not working full time on it. But like, let's imagine that you're doing that. Whereas like even the small teams we got back in the day, like, you know, Fallout 1 was probably made by like 15 or 20 people for the most part. And, you know, that's the people whose job it was when, you know, and that was made in like, I think like 18 months. The people whose job it is to write and like script, instead of one person that has to both write and script, like, they can spend the entire, like, the vast majority of their time in the dev cycle just doing that. And so that separation of concerns just means that it's much easier to make that kind of game. You know, so, like, just having everyone focused on their own specific discipline just gives you a lot more capacity to make games that are detailed in the kind of way that people kind of want their computer style RPGs to be. I'm not asking for something with the budget scope of Dragon Age Veilguard. Yeah, it's just a lot of stuff that makes it a little it's difficult to pursue. And like the other thing is, you know, and you might say, like, you know, get people to collaborate and like all come together on these, but it's hard to get people to all agree on a vision when, you know, you're working on an indie game where there's no guarantee everyone's getting paid. Like, not yeah. everyone's getting paid, but that anyone will make a substantial amount of money is how I should put it. You know,
I think that's why I made the original comment about like AA studio or higher to begin with. Is just the
yeah, it's not, having main, publisher backing makes a lot.
High, you have to actually be able to afford it.
Yeah, because like you know, like to get you know. Everyone's going to have their own vision for the games they're working on, even in the AAA space. But the difference is that when you're signing someone's checks and they just work for you, at some point they're going to put aside that they disagree with you and just accept that this is the product they're making.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
well, like become... even Obsidian had to do a Kickstarter for Pillars of Eternity, you know? So.
Did they do one for both of them, or just the first game?
I think just the first one. Yeah.
Tyranny also had a Kickstarter, though.
Okay.
But
I forgot that game existed.
It's apparently pretty good. I've just never played it.
Yeah, I played a little bit of it, and it's like... The whole premise is that the evil tyrant already won, and you're just one of his lackeys, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that's neat. Okay.
Yeah, it's a cute idea. I'm saying, I guess the question boils down to, is making a non-linear story-focused RPG inherently more risky and resource-intensive than a linear RPG? Yeah. It's going to depend a little bit on, like, oftentimes linear RPGs end up in their critical path being markedly longer. Like, if you were to just bolt through the required content of... some of those old school computer RPGs, many of them are only like 10 hours long. But, you know, like, you separate out a lot of concerns about potential player states. You have a lot of things that you can just sweep off the table. On the other hand, a linear RPG is probably going to, like, in general, if the linear RPG, in terms of its content, is going to be comparable to being fairly thorough in the non-linear RPG. You're going to have to probably end up generating a similar amount of art assets, possibly more, and a similar amount of writing, but you're also going to be able to guarantee that most players will actually see it, and there might not be... There'll be fewer questions of the exponential increase in complexity that comes from not knowing if the player saw something prior that could theoretically affect the current situation they're in. So it's a lot of... It's hard to compare them apples to apples. It's also just... You know, if you're going to the trouble of doing all that writing, I think part of it also comes down to, if you're going to the trouble of doing all that writing, the kind of person who's, you know, running a small indie studio that might only have a couple of people in it, maybe, like, if that's the kind of, if they're wanting to tell a story, they probably have an idea of how that story they want to play out. So... It again comes down to also the temperament of the kind of person who can complete these kinds of projects. Because I'm sure plenty of people have started, you know, games in the vein of Baldur's Gate or Fallout or such, and just never gotten around to them, never finished them. Like, they live incomplete as design documents and half-finished code. Potentially never shown to anyone other than the one or two people working on them. And that's, you know, it just sort of comes down a lot to resources, temperament, and a lot of other concerns. But I wouldn't say that it's inherently more risky, but the kinds of risks it produces can be harder to work through with a small team. What's the other thing I was going to say? This does remind me that I should pick up... there's a few old-school RPG-adjacent things that have actually just been re-released. Notably, System Shock 2 Remastered, which just came out on all major consoles and PC. And Neverwinter Nights 2. I'm not sure what they ended up calling that remaster, enhanced edition. I don't know.
Something like
that. But it has Neverwinter Nights 2 and its 3 expansions. So, you know, the old, there's probably at least one classic in that genre that you haven't played yet. So, no matter who you may be, so. Maybe look through some of those. Who here has bought the collector's boxes for Magic? Wheels spoke of the evil within. Speaking of horses, has anyone here tried Umamusume? No, I have not. I do not play gacha games. Can you believe that it's been 5 years since Wasteland 3 came out and the studio hasn't put out anything new since then? Wasteland 3 would have been In Exile, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Let me double check. Yeah, In Exile.
Owned by Microsoft, right?
Yeah, they've recently been purchased. Well, not recently, but shortly after Wasteland 3, they would have been purchased by Microsoft. And we know what they're working on. It appears to be some sort of first-person action RPG immersive sim type thing that has a release date of fuck you whenever it's brought up. like, they've shown that a couple of times, and at no point has it seemed like it was even close to release. I would imagine that between the upheaval over that, over being purchased by Microsoft, and whatever the fuck is going on with Clockwork Revolution, we know what they're working on, but also, like, the scale of Clockwork Revolution looks like it's large enough that they probably had to do a huge hiring spree. And that likely necessitated a lot of time in pre-production while they figured out what it was that this new, likely much larger staff was now making. And now we've got this genuinely very cool, if it's allowed to come out. No guarantees given Microsoft, but...
Yep.
like, genuinely very cool looking thing with Clockwork Revolution, but... Also evidently, like, one that seems to have, like, a lot of potential technology bottlenecks with its, heavily, with its, like, alternate timeline, based, concept that seems to, potentially have multiple factions repeatedly rewriting history.
That's very, what's the word here?
Ambitious?
Yes, thank you.
So yeah, like that seems like it has both a lot of writing and technological hurdles, so it's not surprising In Exile is having some issues with that one. I'd like that to come out. I'm not the most confident in the world that it will be allowed to, but we shall see. Speaking of indie game, what do you think about Inzoid, the most promising Sims alternative at the moment, using AI to create assets? I think Sims fans have it rough when all the other Sims alternatives have fallen through. Like, yeah, I've seen that one floating around, and, like, I don't like commenting on this kind of thing, because, like, I'm just not a Sims fan, so, like, I'm not someone who's sitting around being disappointed that EA has basically thrown Sims 4 into, like, maintenance hell mode. And is just wanting another thing that will sate my interests, but, like, God, I would rather that, like, the alternative that gets, like, held up as this will save us is not something with this much AI slop involved. bit.
And now here, I like it nice and sloppy.
Oh god. but yeah, I don't want to dig too much into that just because it's just kind of depressing. Like, it's one of those things, like, it just ends up meaning, like, to me, if I were a fucking someone running a studio, I'd be like, there is an obvious market for this. They will accept, you know, they're willing to accept a lot of compromises. You have the chance to come in and eat EA's lunch. Like, The Sims is still genuinely one of the highest selling PC games, or just games in general of all time. And EA has shown, like, a disinterest in, like, really iterating on it beyond just selling content packs to an increasingly frustrated loyal fan base. This would not be a cheap thing to make, which is why at least one company is deciding that they're just going to defray that cost by AIing it up a bit. Ugh. But I think that, like, there's a lot, there's a big addressable market that is deeply underserved, and if I was running a publisher of even moderate size, I would be looking at, like, well, can we take some of that market? Because I think we could make some money here. And it's just kind of depressing. I, like, if it were me, I would probably suck it up and not bother. But I'm not the you know, desperate for new content Sims fan that is having to make that decision. Speaking of original Fallout, it recently came out that Interplay's co-founder still has the original voice recording for that game. That doesn't surprise me. A lot of people just sort of keep things. Another founder has the source codes for Fallout and Fallout 2, and she is exploring the idea of publishing the source code. That would be nice, just because Fallout 1 and 2 are infamously huge pains in the ass to mod. They have been around for decades, have a wildly loyal cult fan base, and have approximately 4 user-generated campaigns between them.
Oh, wow.
Hello? And approximately half of them were made by one extremely dedicated Russian man.
Jeez.
they have names like Fallout Sonora. But, it's, you know, it would be nice if that source code could get out, because it would potentially make it much easier to mess around with the game's internals, so that people might actually be able to generate more content for those kinds of games within that familiar, like, Fallout basis. So, you know, fingers crossed, that would be nice to see. I sometimes forget how late in the Famicom's lifetime the classic Mega Man games came out. Really gives credence to the idea that Mega Man is kind of the crystallization of Famicom platformers, while also the forerunner of what's to come. Yeah, I want to say original Mega Man's 87. Let me double check. It might be 88. 87. Well, yeah.
You guys might get a kick out of this. So Final Fantasy 14 has a Cid, because they all have a Cid.
Of course they do.
And he's got 3 helpers. I think their names are Riggs, Wedge, and Jesse. We know those names, don't we?
Yeah, and Big Wedge and Jesse.
Yeah, and I was just chuckling because this character named Nero that Cid hates just popped up, and he's like, oh no, you've got to be kidding me. And now, so starts the quest line that connects Stormblood to Shadowbringers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just thought it was funny.
But, yeah, so, the original Mega Man came out about 4 years into the Famicom's lifespan in Japan, but, like, the ones that are popular are respectively, like, 5, 6, 7 years in, so.
It
pretty deep in there. So yeah, there's an argument for that. Okay. How expensive are physical Switch games in Japan right now? The original Mega Man X retailed for 9,500 yen. Would you know this, Gaijin? How expensive are physical Switch games in Japan?
I mean, looking in between 6,000 to 8,000 yen new.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Getting into exchange rates, a lot less than it would be in America. Mm-hmm. It's still like at 144 yen to the dollar exchange rate. So, mm-hmm. About in the $40 to $60 range.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. And the prices haven't actually changed that much in mm-hmm. a while.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, of course, it's also if you buy, like, if you get them the first, like, as they come out and special deals and things, or special sets. It's going to be a little more expensive then, but yeah. Secondhand mm-hmm. market's still pretty low. So we're talking about 4,000 yen for a used game. Or for some of the more popular used games that are still pretty numerous.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. For secondhand market, Game Boy Advance games have gone through the roof. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah, it's about the right age for that.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking like five figures in yen at this point for some of these.
Lord.
In a couple cases, like, okay, that's like rent money. Or this game that I know is not that good. Like, how did this happen? Okay.
Okay, so we've got a string of related questions about Persona 5 and Persona 5X that I'm going to briefly roll through before I decide that I'm too tired to continue. as this continues to drain my life force. So from what I've been reading...
Hold on, I just want to say I have to get in a thank you for following Ncoopdog, which is... This is on my stream. Which is totally not a longtime friend I told to watch.
That'd be silly.
Of course.
That would be silly.
It's not a guy you've known since high school, no.
Of course not. Anyway,
I think I know who it is, but I would, yeah, that's fine.
I can save that for after. Okay, so Fireman says, so from what I've been reading, Persona 5X has been getting a lot of flack for Sega's many mistakes committed at launch, chiefly stinginess for giving out free rolls when the game is on an accelerated schedule to catch up with other regions' releases. Moreover, people reported the story, dialogue, mechanics, etc. have not been impressing them that much compared to the mainline games. Not surprised, it is a mobile game that is also a content treadmill. There is not as much time to sit back and consider how dialogue will fit over the course of a game that is beginning meant to have a beginning, middle, and end.
Mm-hmm.
There was some shit coming out from like the director of that was honestly like even if what he's saying is true, I feel like it was kind of unprofessional to say it. Like, one of the first major arcs in the game that's been getting a lot of jokes about it is the guy who's just, like, really rude and shoving people on the subway. And, like, you're gonna go in and change this man's heart. And, like, basically, the director, I think, was just going on social media and, like, talking shit about the guy who wrote it and, like, assuring people that the other ones are better. And it's like, I don't even if that's true, that's kind of just, like, a fucked thing to do. You're the director. Like, you're saying, like, oh, he insisted that it would be good, and I'm like, okay, but you're the director. The buck stops with you. But, yeah, you know, game of telephone as I'm, like, reading other people's translations of what he was saying on social media. But it is one of those things where it's like, if there is any truth to what I read, I would just be like, man, It was your responsibility to make sure if you saw this and thought this isn't turning out well, that you, you know, step in and stop it before it comes out. But, yeah, this begs the question. P5X has made four Persona fans. You can't wait to get more Persona. Why the hell have so many studios tried to make a Persona clone and failed? Remember Valkyria Chronicles 2? Not when I can help it.
Nope.
Conception 2, even less when I can help it, as, except for the infectious You Had a Horrible Child song.
Just a good point. It's a good item to point out is that when people are thinking about the Persona style of game, what they're really thinking of is the Gakuen Mono genre, which does predate Persona 3. It's just that Persona 3 has become such an archetype version of it that everyone's...
It's also in part that a lot of the game... A lot of the way that that concept is implemented in games, like Persona has definitely had an outsized influence on that implementation.
I've played PlayStation 1 games, obviously, before Persona 3 came out. Had a very similar gameplay loop.
Yeah, I mean, it dates back to things like Sakura Taisen as well.
Yep. So
and then you date that back to...
Yeah. It's not that games are copying Persona 3 so much as Persona 3 had... Or 3, 4, and 5 all had a certain level of style on top of the game mechanics, and that's the part that's kind of hard to disengage from everything else. So, it's like...
But yeah. I mean, broadly speaking, the reason that a lot of these don't have much penetration in English is that a lot of the ones that get brought over are kind of bad. Like, you know... you'd think that a dungeon crawler in an urban fantasy setting with a relationship system is something that's been refined so much it should have been taught at school. Conversely, the fact that just how difficult was it for Atlas to make P5 while P4's success necessitated having P3 as the rough first draft, meaning that making a Persona clone is extremely difficult. I'd say it's extremely difficult, but I will say that there are games that more than a lot kind of live and die on writing. You gotta have a lot of, like, the characters are archetypal, but they've still gotta be charming. That's a tough tightrope to walk. Persona had to draw on a variant of SMT Nocturne's press turn system, which helped it a lot, because that's a strong that's a strong battle system that a lot of these end up lacking. Persona is also able to draw a lot of art assets from its fellow SMT games. Like, you can pilfer a lot of, like, enemy and persona models straight out of whatever Shin Megami Tensei game is contemporary, or in Persona's case, you might use Persona's art budget as an excuse to make a lot of stuff that is technically part of the game's development cost, but which you might is technically defraying the development cost of a lot of other games just by existing. Those ultimately mean that budgeting's a little easier. So the less that you're spending on that asset generation, the more you can spend on things like scripting and interesting scenario concepts and fun like getting those characters and all that. Making sure that you nail those is really, you know, it's a lot of work. And, you know, a lot of these games that we see doing that are games that are ultimately kind of low budget. They don't, like, if they're knee deep into scripting and, you know, it turns out that they're not able to make this character or this storyline work, they don't really have the option of throwing it away. They just have to try to do their best with it. And I think that probably ends up hurting them a lot when you put them head to head with Persona as well. It's sort of like, you know, you go back to, you know, the antecedents, things like Tokimemo or Sakura Wars. There's a ton of other things that are like them, but are not built to the same level of quality because, you know, Sakura Wars is Sega company used to spending money hand over fist and getting essentially no sales in return and taking years to do it. So Sakura Wars gets a lot of time in the oven and it's contracted with Red Entertainment, a company with a proven track record of making hit RPGs at the time, like Tengai Makyo.
And really weird stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Being
very inventive and creative.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Tokimemo was Konami at the height of their power. You know, there's a ton of, like, Tokimeki Memorial 2 spends like 4 years in development and is a 5-disc PS1 game. Like,
yeah,
it's a wildly budgeted dating sim with just tons of like weird, unique interactions and characters. Like, money was spent, and the same as any other genre. Like, having more money means that you get a lot more chances if something isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And as one last answer, what will happen if you give Tokimeki to Kojima? That already happened. He is credited as a producer on several of the Tokimemo spinoffs that are, like, not dating sims, but pure strain, like, romantic visual novels. I'd say 3 of them. I forget what they're called, but let me double check. Yeah, Tokimeki Memorial Drama Series or whatever. Yeah, it looks like they were called Tokimeki Memorial Drama Series, and they were more traditional, like, adventure games instead of being the, like, life sim strategy type games that are the underpinnings of, like, proper Tokimeki Memorial. They were made by, like, a bunch of people who had worked on, like, Snatcher and Police Knots. So yes, we actually know what that looks like. Go look those up. No one has translated them, but they do exist. And with that, my voice is starting to give out, so I think you should tell me what I should read instead of talk about.
Oh, yes. Give me a moment here. Yeah. So, yes. Thinking about issues with numerous game states and the problems of programming and everything, and realizing that there's a reason why tabletop RPGs continue to be popular, because our brains can just make up stuff if necessary. It's always nice. So, but unfortunately, we rarely have enough time to play, which is why actual plays and things like that on the internet are a thing. Go figure. So if you enjoy that sort of entertainment and you wouldn't mind reading it in ebook or dead tree format, we have Princesses of the Pizza Parlor on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited, all about playing tabletop role-playing games and the flip side of the fantasy world where all the action is supposed to take place. I've been told it was crazy to actually base part of the writing method on actual dice rolls, but, you know, it's been fun. The crazy part was giving a character a Rod of Wonder. fun. That, quote unquote, fun. But yeah, so Princesses of the Pizza Parlor. I really need to get that next side story out, because I actually have the cover ready for it now. Okay, so that's 13 episodes, soon to be 5 side stories, 1 paralogue. The 4th collection, so the 5th paperback collection, should be available at the end of the month if you are interested in physicals. Thoughts. And beyond that, also, if you are interested in folklore, Japanese culture, and just cute animal stories, we have Tanuki as a Teapot, Japanese folktales all about animals, again, under the name Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. Various random, sometimes very obscure Japanese folktales, retold and partially illustrated by yours truly. Just because I can. All fun. switching up genres, we have in the lit RPG genre a different take on how to imagine the game that you would really like to exist in this world. We have Vainglorious, Long as the Night, which, I mean, unfortunately for Dave's case, this is all Metroidvania styled. oddly enough, there are not a lot of Metroidvania lit RPG books. So, which is kind of weird, but trying to work with it. Managed to stick some Castlevania quotes in there. So, yes, including the one you're exactly thinking of right now, I'm sure.
What is a man, though?
Yes, you know, that's actually featured within the last 20 pages of the book. So,
I would expect no less.
Nice.
Yeah. Or a paraphrase, at least. And beyond that, I'm also trying to branch out into a different age range of publishing under a different pen name, because, you know what, having something verging into the romantasy subgenre under the same name as somebody who's writing young adult fantasy, probably not the best intersection of audiences. Probably not. I've got something coming out at the end of the month under the name Michael Spearwater. Spearwater, sure. And it's a travelogue, romanticy. It's vaguely based, or not so vaguely based, on Around the World in 80 Days, just because, you know, it was a good thing to make fun of, or to not make fun of, to... What's the right word here?
Pastiche.
Thank you. Make a pastiche of. And so it's been fun. It is definitely not a children's book in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the random challenges I put on myself for that particular NaNoWriMo sequence. Mainly it's out there. It's going to be out there just to have it out there.
Yeah.
And also, so I have a nice copy for my shelf to decorate. So, reading through the paper, the author's copy, I'm like, okay, need to make this edit here, change these things here. So I've actually edited it more since I got the author's copy. I've got a bit over a week before I have to have it finalized for actual publication, so it's all good. That'll be...
For those who don't know, Yari means spear, and that's why Yuridovich was in your copy of Super Mario RPG.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I was actually kind of happy to find out that Spearwater was an actual legitimate English surname, even if it's not been on the American census rolls in 200 years.
makes it fancy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not one of those that has survived time and the test of time. Based on the ongoing issue of the number of surnames will inevitably dwindle just from attrition.
Yeah. Until someone decides that they're just going to make up new ones.
Yeah. It happens sometimes. I mean, look at Thailand. That's one reason why Japan has fail-safes for like having husbands marry into the wife's family to maintain the family names.
Mm-hmm.
Which The West does not do that, but no. Oh well.
We've started kind of making new ones just by hyphenating. But that limited utility. But yeah.
Or merging. Yeah. You know, I'm just gonna keep digging up old surnames to reuse and just have fun with it.
Yeah. Yeah, give those a look. They're on Amazon. Kindle Unlimited. And Dead Tree Format.
Yeah.
Oh, where can we find you?
Oh, you can still find me on Blue Sky, Twitch, and YouTube under Smoke and Joe Gamer. So for JRPG July, I've just been streaming Visions of Mana on the RP Gamer channel, which you're watching right now. Wow, how about that? So you check it out on Tuesday and Thursday nights from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Eastern Time. You can watch me play some Visions of Mana. I'm hoping to finish that by the end of the month. So I haven't been doing a lot of stuff on my own Twitch or YouTube channels, but that's not to say that I can't or won't. So maybe I'll do a Tony Hawk stream. Maybe I'll do a Donkey Kong stream. We'll see. Yeah, so check that out. Yeah, if you give me a follow on Blue Sky, sometimes I post there about any updates to the schedule. You can also check the schedule on twitch.tv/smokeandjoegamer. And then I haven't done any YouTube videos since June. Just a bunch of, you know, Switch 2 streams that got exported over, so you can check those out. But yeah, consider liking, subscribing, following, whatever terminology they use, and then that might motivate me to do more content. We'll see.
As for us, you can catch us as we stream on Sundays and Mondays, 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern. Mondays are this very podcast, Q&A Quest. If you catch us when we're streaming, we try to answer questions. As long as I have not grown to the stage of the night where I start yawning. On Sundays, me, Wheels, some combination of me, Wheels, and Joe, play multiplayer games and try not to hate each other by the end of it. Results inconclusive.
Never cheat at Tony Hawk.
How do you cheat at Tony Hawk?
They literally have built-in cheats.
People play eating animals.
Hey, I didn't cheat till after he cheated.
I was going to say, is it really a cheat if it's actually encoded?
I enjoy that opinion.
In any case, this week we will probably all just be playing Donkey Kong Bonanza and being all going ape.
Donkey
Kong. Yeah, I'll watch you guys play that Wild Hearts game. I just have no interest in it.
That's not until next week.
Okay, yeah. And then they're adding Phoenix to Marvel Rivals, so we might be doing that at some point.
Yes, definitely.
Oh. Yeah, that'll definitely happen. But yeah, this week, though, it'll just be us going ape spit over Donkey Kong Bonanza. So let us all mourn Toki going ape spit. Garbage video game for your Sega Genesis. But yeah, you can also ask us questions in the podcast section of the RP Gamer Discord. You can get to the RP Gamer Discord by going to rpgamer.com and clicking the community tab for the invite. It is a lovely community, whether you want to ask us questions or not, but we always do appreciate them. You can also ask us questions in the comment section under this very episode. Don't put them in your podcast review, the review section of your podcast thing of choice. We don't read those.
Has somebody done that?
I don't know. Because we've never looked at them, I'm not sure. So I'm just trying to cover my bases.
Okay, fair.
But yeah. So that's about wrapped it up for this week. My throat and head are killing me. So see ya, Space Cowboys.
See ya.
See ya.
Yeah.
On my own, far from home, I was scared. Yeah.